To start out this morning, we have a presentation by the National Marine Fisheries Service on the final rule for limited access privilege programs. It's document number 8 behind tab number 1. Dan Morris is going to lead us through the presentation. Dan, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity to speak to the council, and I hope you all get on the edges of your seat as we're about to review the procedures and guidelines for conducting an IFQ referendum. The Reauthorized Magnuson-Stevens Act... My presentation will be up in just a second. I'll proceed. The Reauthorized Magnuson-Stevens Act included a new section, 303 Alpha, that authorizes and provides the basic requirements for establishing limited access privilege programs, or LAPs. Section 303 Alpha C6D includes a special bonus for New England and Gulf of Mexico councils. I'll paraphrase and focus on only the New England requirement. The New England Council may not submit an FMP or amendment that creates an IFQ unless the IFQ proposal, as ultimately developed, has been approved by two-thirds of those voting in a referendum. If the proposal doesn't get approved by the referendum, the Council may revise it and request a subsequent referendum. NIMS shall publish guidelines and procedures to determine procedures and voting eligibility requirements to conduct such referendum in a fair and equitable manner. NIMS shall promulgate criteria for determining whether additional fishery participants are eligible to vote to ensure crew members who derive a significant percentage of their total income from the subject fishery are eligible to participate in the referendum. Essentially, the Act establishes an elaborate approval process for any IFQ proposal the Council would like to submit. I'll try to walk us through this process, and in the interest of time, I think I'm going to skip these first couple of slides and just get right to the process. We'll hit on all those points as we go through this. That slide, of course, is very busy. There are handouts out on the table with this, and we're going to go to a finer scale so you can see some of these sections and actually read what this slide says. First, applicability. Note that we're talking about IFQ proposals. Recall that the definition of a limited access privilege program is a bit broader than that for an IFQ. A LAP is a permit authorizing harvest of a quantity of fish expressed as a portion of the TAC. And an IFQ, for an IFQ, that quantity is expressed as a percentage. So there may be room in those definitions between portion and percentage for a LAP that is not also an IFQ. It's a tight squeeze, though. Also, sector proposals are expressly exempted from the referendum requirement. A question arose late in the rulemaking about how the referendum requirement would apply to FMPs under joint jurisdiction of the Mid-Atlantic and New England councils. Though one council is the administrative lead for dogfish and the other for monkfish, the jurisdiction is shared and the management actions are approved and submitted jointly. Therefore, the New England Council, for its part, would still have to go through the referendum process to submit a proposal, even if jointly. As far as timing goes, the referendum must consider the IFQ proposal as ultimately developed. And the procedures, the Act and the procedures and guidelines do not provide for voting on a general plan or on a concept of an IFQ, nor does it allow voters to select from a number of alternatives. As we'll see later, the Council may request the referendum after public hearings and selection of preferred alternatives. But the referendum may not be conducted until the IFQ program proposal and the supporting analyses are complete and, but for the referendum, ready to submit to the Secretary for review. One final note, then I'll move to the diagram itself. Vote weighting. The text of the Act is totally silent on the weighting of votes. But the legislative history indicated that Congress was open to the idea. So, under these procedures and guidelines, weighting is allowed, but is not required. A couple years ago, before this requirement, there was a referendum for red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico for an IFQ down there, and they did use weighting. It was based on landings. More recently, in October time frame, they conducted a referendum for grouper and tilefish, and they did not use weighting. But weighting could be based on whatever factors the council determines are appropriate for that particular fishery. They used landings, and that may be the basis of your quota distribution, but your quota may also be based on something else. So it's open to those other weighting measures, such as vessel size, days at sea, or years in the fishery. So so long as the plan for weighting can be presented to NIMS and determined to be fair and equitable and consistent with the IFQ proposal itself. Okay, so before we move on, I'd like to point at that diamond right in the middle and see all the arrows pointing to it. Those are indicative of the many opportunities for do-overs in this process, or mulligans for you golfers. If NIMS concludes that the council's criteria would not provide for a fair and equitable referendum, the request will be sent back to the council. If comments on the proposed rule somehow present a showstopper, the council would get another shot at adjusting the criteria or even the IFQ proposal itself. If the proposal fails to get a two-thirds majority, the council can rework the proposal, or the IFQ proposal, and try it again. So looking a little more closely, after the council has developed an IFQ proposal, subjected it to public hearings, and considered the comment that's been received, and selected a preferred alternative, the council may request that the secretary conduct a referendum. The letter to NIMS needs to include voter eligibility criteria, crew member for New England, crew member eligibility criteria, including a threshold of the percentage of income of that fisherman's or the crew member's income that would be considered significant for the purposes of qualifying for this to vote. And if there's to be vote weighting, it must explain that as well. It must also include rationale and analysis to support a determination by NIMS that the criteria are fair and equitable, and perhaps also to support rulemaking. The procedures and guidelines that were published in mid-December as a final rule list some points that the council should consider when developing eligibility criteria for permit holders. Basically, these are going to follow your deliberations for quota allocation itself. So that's the primary concern, that the criteria are reasonably linked to the proposal, the IFQ proposal, and the quota allocation proposal itself. And, you know, consider things like current and past harvest, participation in the fishery, and other factors that are important to the council. The requirement to include crew members presents a few challenges for us. And we're to ensure, just as a reminder, that crew members who earn a significant percentage of their income from the of their total income from the fishery have an opportunity to vote. That prompts questions like, what exactly is a crew member for the purposes of this? Who are the crew members? What is a significant percentage of one's income? And how do we document that? We don't have great documentation of crew member participation in the fishery, and certainly don't have documents on their income. So we do have a basic definition of a crew member in the final rule. It's very basic. The crew member must have worked aboard a referendum-eligible vessel at sea during the qualifying period while the vessel was engaged in fishing. Beyond that basic definition, it's up to the council to set more specific criteria. And we've tried to provide the structure to support development of those eligibility criteria and the execution of the referendum without tying your hands and while maintaining flexibility to suit any particular FMP. Okay. And just a note on that, the significance, what is a significant percentage of one's income? We suggest in the procedures and guidelines that the council consider employment practices, business practices, and other economic factors in determining what significance is. And again, the availability of documents to support the proof of a crew member meeting those criteria. Okay. When the council submits its letter to NIMS, the agency gets its first assessment of the request, we ask, will the voter eligibility criteria provide for a fair and equitable referendum? NIMS considerations in making that determination include, are the criteria reasonably connected to the IFQ program objectives? Do the criteria prevent excessive share of votes to be held by a single entity? Are the documentation requirements for crew eligibility reasonable and attainable? Is this something we're going to be able to execute in a reasonable amount of time? Are the data requirements too onerous to do it quickly? Is it legal per national standards, MSA, and other law? Assuming everything looks to be fair and equitable, we'll proceed with rulemaking. The proposed rule will describe the IFQ proposal, the referendum process, and the eligibility and weighting criteria. Next, assuming we encounter no showstoppers on the with the proposed rule, we'll proceed to final rule. We'll provide ballots and information packages to the known eligible voters. But remember, we don't have data on who the crew members are. So we'll have to announce the referendum publicly so eligible voters we don't know about can come forward and claim a ballot. Of course, starting the outreach earlier may help expedite distribution of ballots. Also, depending on the basis for permit holder and crew member eligibility and waiting, we may have to have an appeals process to resolve questions about data. Industry voting is the next phase. Depending on how the eligibility criteria shake out and the documentary proof of eligibility that's required, the issuing of ballots for crew members should take a while. Or could take a while. We have to allow at least 30 days for the issuance and return of the ballots, but we anticipate it will take longer if there's going to be significant documentation requirements for crew members. And to help expedite the referendum process, the procedures and guidelines do allow for the council to opt to have individuals self-certify that they meet the eligibility criteria. There would be a statement on the ballot that says, under penalty of law and investigation and possible enforcement action, I do certify that I meet the following eligibility criteria. And that would be part of the ballot, and they would certify that and be able to proceed without having to present paperwork that would have to be verified and processed before getting the ballot. That option is available to the council. The ballots themselves are to be very simple. We will not present a set of alternatives to vote on. The voter would indicate approval or disapproval. Also, if votes are to be weighted, the entire block must be applied in approval or disapproval. If you can't quite decide but are leaning, you shouldn't put 60% of your points on one side and 40 on the other. The whole block has to go to one side or the other. Okay. All right. Finally, the votes are tallied. NIMS has up to 90 days to validate and tally the votes. Hopefully, it'll take much less time than that. But if greater than two-thirds of the submitted votes favor the proposal, then the council may then submit the IFQ proposal to NIMS for review. So this is all just to authorize the council to submit the IFQ proposal to the secretary. Any changes made to the IFQ proposal subsequent to the referendum may invalidate the vote. So if there's some late-breaking news that would change the proposal, we'd have to reinitiate the referendum. If fewer than two-thirds of the submitted votes favor the proposal, then the council may reconfigure the IFQ proposal and reinitiate the process. So that's it as quick and dirty as I can provide it. If you have any questions, I'll gladly entertain them. Or if you'd prefer to move on to other things, I'll entertain that too.
Thanks, Dan. When you were creating this presentation and discussions you've had in the regional office, I find it hard to believe you wouldn't talk about how long it would take to actually go through this process.
Okay. I can cite an example, a recent example of how the Southeast has done this. And theirs is a very simple process. They do not have crew member involvement. And I can give you the details on that. One reason we're hesitant to provide a full calendar of this is because the variety of or the range of criteria that could be provided. When I spoke with the council about this some time ago, there was a lot of interest in making quite sure that crew members presented documents and were validated as crew members meeting the criteria. And lacking any of those documents on hand, we would have to contact the industry, have them submit them, review them, and validate their documents before proceeding. And we were concerned about how long that will take. So we have not included a timeline. And I apologize for that, but I can give you an example of a simpler version that in the Southeast region, they relied on the proposed rule, which was very similar to the final rules, and they proceeded in, on September 4th, they had their proposed referendum as a proposed rule. On October 30th, so almost 2 months later, they published the final rule. Ballots were mailed out on December 1st with a 30-day response time. So starting the process at the 1st of September, by the end of the year, they had completed their referendum. By the way, there was 80% approval, and these were also unweighted votes. There was no crew member involvement, and it was the only standard for or the only criterion was having a certain level of landings as proven by actually vessel logbooks. So it was a very straightforward one. That took 3 months to execute from the proposed rule on, probably a month of preparation for the proposed rule. Yes, sir.
Dan, one of the council's biggest concerns early on in our comments were that we didn't want to spend all our valuable resources and time and money up front and then have the referendum say we don't want a IFQ program. But it appears that's the way it's going to be, that we'd have to go through our whole NEPA process, develop five alternatives or whatever it is, have the council vote on the alternative that it wants, and then have NIMS determine what all the landings are for that, whatever the council voted on, so the public knows what they're voting on, then go to a referendum. So it's very, you know, resource-intensive and a long process. So recognizing that's how it ended up, what can we do ahead of time? I think the only way we could make this work is if we have commitment up front in some type of pre-referendum. Is there any way, Gene or anyone, we could do a pre-referendum and not binding, but we certainly don't want to go through years of work and then have the final outcome, 20% of the folks wanted it. Have you thought about that?
We have thought about it, and there is a provision. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference right in front of me, but under 303 alpha for a proponent's petition for a LAP, in which proponents would petition permit holders and others for their level of interest in a limited access privilege program and present that to the council. And I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me to present the details, but at some level of participation, the council must consider the possibility of that LAP. But beyond that, no, I think that it's a matter of intense outreach and education to get you to that point. The difficulty in that we had was with that term as ultimately developed. We couldn't find a way to allow for approval of some concept or type of IFQ without having the final final version for consideration for the voters.
Sally?
Yeah, thanks for this. At this point, I just have a few comments. First, thank you for the presentation. I think this is very helpful and extremely timely as we're just getting ready to initiate a monkfish amendment, and there's been interest expressed in industry in pursuing an ITQ there. You know, certainly that's not the only fishery in New England where this approach should be considered, and I just want to make clear and hope people can kind of see the forest for the trees here, that even though this is something new, the two-thirds supermajority vote is a high bar that New England has to reach, that this is an approach that has worked in the Gulf of Mexico, albeit they have a lower bar. They have different standards that they have to meet in terms of applying a referendum, but it's I would hate for this to be interpreted as yet another bucket of ice on pursuing this potential path for monkfish or other fisheries, and in fact be viewed as, if not definitive down to the details on who qualifies and how you figure out, how you document what their income was from the fishery, that we are provided here with further guidance on how to do this, and that we really should be thinking about this, especially in the context of the monkfish fishery, where we're going to be presumably pursuing this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Also, just to follow on from what Sally was saying, and if you explained this, I didn't hear it. I've been running groundfish things through my head at the moment. But once the criteria have been determined for the crew, whose responsibility is it to make sure that all of the crew get included? Is it the council's responsibility? Is it the permit owner's responsibility, or is it the crew's responsibility in some sort of opt-in program?
I would suggest it's all of the above, though it really relies on the secretary. The act says the secretary shall conduct the referendum under this subparagraph, including notifying all persons eligible to participate in the referendum and making available to them information concerning the schedule, procedures, and eligibility requirements. So it's the secretary's responsibility to do that. We could use whatever outreach vehicles would be available to us. And, I mean, the official statement would be via the Federal Register, but I would hope that there would be other means of reaching out to invite crew members who meet the criteria to present their credentials and try to get a ballot.
Dave Gaith.
Yeah, again, to this idea of the crew voting. From the way you explain this and the way I read it, we can set the bar for who gets to vote, pretty much. Is that correct? The council can determine what constitutes a crewman?
Yes, sir.
So we could set it as narrowly as, say, hired captains and exclude deckhands altogether, or we could be as broad as anybody that's worked on the vessel in any capacity in the qualifying period. Would that be correct?
The only required criterion is the significant percentage of their total income must have been from the subject fishery. So determination of what is significant would be one thing the council could decide. And then any other criteria that the council would choose to apply, as long as they can be determined by the agency as, quote, fair and equitable.
Where I kind of run into problems here and immediately see a huge, you know, we could spend weeks and years on this, is, for example, does somebody still have to be employed in the fishery? I mean, in New England, in a lot of our fisheries, because of the nature of the regulations, crew or the years of permanent, what we call professional crew, are long gone. People who stay with a boat their entire career, or at least 5, 6, 8, 10 years. I mean, now we employ people on a matter of weeks, days, months. You know, a lot of times we go with no crew.
Right.
So a lot of these people may have been crew during the qualifying period but are no longer crew. They may have derived a significant amount of their income during that period, and yet they are no longer employed in the industry in any way, shape, or manner. How do we deal with those kinds of situations?
Well, among the council's consideration are past and current performance or work in the industry. So some sense of how recently they've worked could be among the criteria. The council could also consider setting a minimum income. There are probably high school students out there who get 100% of their income from the fishery by working a couple months during the summer, but you may not consider them eligible to vote on an IFQ. So perhaps setting a bar of, you know, a certain value or income level threshold, as well as the percentage, may be a way for the council to proceed.
If we were to, as an example, just try to avoid that entire discussion and say only, certain people are eligible, let's just say hired captains that are currently operating a vessel as of date X, would that be considered fair and equitable to try and avoid this? I mean, this could take months, years to reconcile, or is that considered too narrow?
Well, I think we'd have to look at the particular circumstance, but there is a requirement. I just want to go back to the text of the Act. Promulgate criteria for determining whether additional fishery participants are eligible to vote in New England referendum in order to ensure that crew members who derive a significant percentage of their total income from the fishery under the proposed program are eligible. That's in the Act. So I would defer to Gene and others for a legal read of it, but it seems you have to at least do that.
Anyone else? Okay. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you for this opportunity. Good day.
Okay, we're on to the 9 a.m. agenda item, which is a discussion of the proposed interim rule. We've got 2 hours set aside for this discussion, but if you recall, yesterday we're also going to